Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
Hi, my name is Michael, and I'm sitting here with the sickest man I know, Eric Ingram. This is weird. I've never started the show before.
Yeah, is it awkward? Or yeah. I think I made you do it on like, oh god, I think one of the walls of the studio just fell. I'm pretty sure I made you do an intro on the fourth episode or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Something weird like that. I guess it's appropriate because we're doing something we don't usually do and something that hopefully we'll never be doing again.
Uh-oh.
I guess we're not supposed to be showing our hand here on how we feel about this. This is a listener decision. But we did this is the Music Box Massacre.
Yeah.
Right now you're hearing us speaking in the year 2010. This
yes.
is our voices in the year 2010.
Right.
In only a few minutes, we will take you back in time.
Right.
To the year 2009, the year that Barack Obama was still a topical person and Sarah Palin's daughter wasn't on Dancing with the Stars. Things like this were not happening.
Oh my God.
Minutes from now.
Also, I wasn't deathly ill all the fucking time.
That's true.
What is going
on
with
that? You weren't sleepy all the time.
Jesus, I'm just getting my ass kicked by the show right now.
But
so I thought I'd fought this cold thing
yeah.
over here. Oftentimes, and you'll remember this from last year on the show, actually, because I remember a whole patch where this happened then, too. I get sick for about 6 months at a time. And so I've been doing everything I can to make sure I sound good on the show and that my voice is okay on those days. But I still...
You did fine last week.
Yeah, I know, but I don't know what's going on this time. Luckily, you're not going to have to hear much more of this voice
right.
until the end of the show.
Exactly.
We're just going to kind of play the thing that happened. And we
yeah.
didn't want to bum people out, so we just wanted to show up
yeah.
and do our job and pay for studio space today and record about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And then go into the thing. So do people have to watch out for spoilers or what do we... Can you just do my
sure.
complete
yeah, no,
job
I'm all
for
over
me?
This.
To, thank you.
You drink some of that, OJ.
Oh, good.
We've got a bunch of movies. I'm pretty sure we're just going to tell you what movies we got. We told you last week what movies we did, and we're going to... I think we marginally spoil them.
Yeah, we tried to stay spoiler-free. There's a couple things, you know, Carrie, you have to talk about the end.
Yeah,
of.
Exactly.
I think I used that exact phrase on the show, you have to talk about it. And everything else is pretty much spoiler free.
Uh-huh.
So kind of a weird thing for us to do, but we did it year one and now we're doing it. Well, we did it year two, I guess. And now we're doing, God, this is so fucking confusing.
This is weird.
Can we just roll the thing? There's chapters, by the way.
Roll
Skip
them.
Around, there's chapters. Other thing, at the very end, we'll come back, and I want to talk about if we're going to do this again. We'll just, I'm just teasing that right now. Stick around, end of the show. We'll talk about if we're doing it again. We want some input. Hit that thing on the control panel over there.
This one?
So we're back in 2009. Here's how you know we're in 2009, because this is the second time we started this show because
yeah.
our equipment just crashed. So I can only hope that in 2010, we will have new equipment.
You
that
mean
will...
2010.
Yeah. So what do you give me your guess on the date, since we can kind of do this retroactive time capsule thing here.
Right.
Do you think people will actually figure out the date by 2010? Or
will they still call it?
Because people right now, the movie 2012 is about to
yeah.
come out, which is apparently how you pronounce the movie's title. People are calling it 2012 instead of 2012. Are they not on the bandwagon
know.
Here?
You know, I think
I'm just hoping the clock rolls over at midnight and everyone gets this shit.
I'm just not sure. Like, I'm afraid it's going to take till like 2111 until there's no zero in the year.
Till all our heads are in jars on robots.
Yeah, pretty much.
So we went to this thing. It's called Music Box Massacre 5.
Five.
And the first film of the night was The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
It was actually the first film of the afternoon.
Yeah, it was.
This thing started at noon on Saturday and went
that is,
till
that's
noon
the title,
on
right?
Sunday. The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Not
to be confused with The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
As our MC announced it. So this was a silent film, and
this was
Lon Chaney Sr.
It was Lon Chaney Sr., who's best known for being ugly. And boy, was he ever. This film has a few really, really fun moments. All the actors... See, here's the thing. I'm gonna advocate and then tear down silent cinema.
All right.
You ready?
Yeah.
The thing I love about silent cinema is everybody acts so flamboyantly.
Yeah, right.
They all the women bat their eyebrows. All the men swing their arms and look
sure.
off into the sky.
It's theater, you know?
Yeah.
It's theater on film. Yeah.
Lon Chaney gets all excited when he pours scalding water on
right.
the soldiers. Like... There is no...
And that
is,
stuff was really enjoyable to
yeah.
watch with an audience because they were all kind of giggling.
There is no
in
more,
chairs.
Like... flamboyant everything going on so much bigger than it needs
it's
to.
It's big. That's what it is.
In silent film. And I love that about silent
film.
They're all
epics. Yeah. You know, they're all like, everything is on a huge scale. You never have an intimate, quiet, silent film. Maybe that's just because the only silent films I watch are like fucking Metropolis, where it's like a huge 3-hour juggernaut. But you were talking about stuff you don't like about silent film.
Well, the thing that I don't like about silent films is anything to interrupt the people overacting.
Sure.
Which would probably 100% of the time come in the form of fucking dialogue cards.
Right.
I hate dialogue cards.
Aren't those kind of necessary, though?
No, you know they're not necessary because the people are overacting so goddamn much
so you kinda that know
when
what's going on anyways.
When fucking Phoebus like points at a goat and then I'm like, haha, he's pointing at a goat. Look how excited he is about a goddamn goat. It cuts to a fucking dialogue card and he's like, look, a goat from yonder farm. Right. And then cuts back to him pointing at a goat, at which point I'm yelling at the screen, I know he saw a goat. He pointed at a goddamn goat. What else could he have possibly been saying?
Right. So title cards a little bit obvious.
Title cards ruin more than anything.
That's how I feel about subtitles.
They ruin the goddamn flow of the film.
Right.
They interrupt the acting, they interrupt the scenes, and they make the film probably twice as long because I read faster than apparently everyone on the planet.
Yeah. This was a little bit, I don't want to like, we've just started the show and I'm already going to start hating everything. To start out with Hunchback, it's not really a horror film. People are going to give it this kind of silent credit that people give silent films. We can make silent films whatever we want them to be because they're silent. So we can just be like, oh, of course it's a horror film. It's just silent, you know? Mm. Of course it's a French drama. It's just silent. You can't tell.
They're French.
Like, yeah, it's anything you want to say about a French film, you then get away with this excuse of, oh, but it's silent. So you're not allowed to criticize a French film because then you look like an idiot who just can't respect, you know, ancient, aging cinema. Mm-hmm. But this is the wrong film to start a horror marathon.
I enjoyed the film. Like, I would have enjoyed the film. Honestly, I probably would have enjoyed it later in the night when I was more ready to sit and pay attention to film. Because this was noon, like the first film. I just want something that's going to captivate me. And I found myself really struggling to like alternate between watching and reading.
Well, it's the film that's supposed to get you into. I mean, all right. So we're going to talk a lot about the lineup here. Because that's the only art we know on Double Feature is how to line up films. Starting with something that's silent, it's the same thing they did at Music Box Massacre 4.
But it worked because it was silly.
Sure. You know, the other thing that was cool at Music Box Massacre 4 is you had the live organ.
That's true.
No live organ here was kind of a letdown for me because I've been to the Massacre before. If you'd never been there before, I'm sure you didn't give a shit. There was something about that was really amusing. Maybe they couldn't have a live organ because it was fucking 3.5 hours long and the guy would have killed himself.
Should we mention Until We Fall before we move into...
Oh, you know, we should, just because what the fuck? What is Until We Fall?
Is it Until We Fall?
Is that
the
name?
When We Fall.
When We Fall.
It's When We Fall.
Okay.
When We Fall is this intrepid little metal project by these two young boys.
Right.
Who actually opened the Massacre. So the Massacre wasn't opened by
I think
Silent
that was
Lon
a better
Chaney.
Way to start than
It was
a
opened
Lon
by
Chaney
these
film.
These two young, I don't know how old they are, maybe 11.
I'm going to call this it's a 12-year-old local metal band.
Yeah.
That's what this is.
And it's just a drummer
like Cannibal
and a
Corpse
singer.
Style.
And
if Cannibal Corpse were covered by the White Stripes.
And, exactly. And the reality is, you know, they're you know, 11, 12 years old. They're doing their thing. And in another 8 years, you know, in what year will that be? 2018.
Right.
They'll be doing their thing louder.
It's really cool that they get to play at the Music Box too. So you hadn't seen these two kids perform though? Okay, so just to kind of set the backdrop here, I mean, you described it pretty well, but we get there and as people are kind of coming in and taking their seats, not even on the stage, but in like in front of the first row, there's this fucking metal band, these two kids. When I saw Sci-Fi Spectacular, which is another event the Music Box puts on, they were playing there too. And actually I did think that they got significantly better between the two. I feel a little awkward because you know that whoever put them on the stage knows that the audience is going, oh, they're so cute. Yeah. And they're kind of like, hey, guys, we're serious, you know? And so there's like this weird, ironic kind of thing about it that rubs me the wrong way. But I always enjoy when I go to a Chicago film event and When We Fall is playing. All right. So When We Fall and Hunchback aside, there is one thing I want to say about Hunchback, aside from that it was a terrible pick for the Massacre. I get you want to start with a silent film. Old monster stuff, man. I mean, why not? There's tons of other silent films you could have done. It was a lazy choice. How do you feel about Sanctuary? This was something they mentioned in the film. Sanctuary is a thing it's like your nation's embassy in a foreign country.
Yeah.
You know, if you once you've run into a church, you have sanctuary, and no one can.
If you claim sanctuary,
is that
you
how
can't
it works?
Just run into a church.
Okay, so you have sanctuary, and
people
no one
are
can,
shit out of luck.
No one can harm you. That's, you know, that still kind of works today. I mean, people still,
it works.
If it was a high enough profile thing, I mean, I guess yeah. they just wait for the person to leave the church.
Yeah, but well, I don't
know.
Do
people get sanctuary just because they go into a fucking religious
building?
It's hard
for me. It's hard for me to gauge. I don't know the rules of sanctuary. Right. I can see that it probably falls somewhere between separation of church and state.
Yeah.
Like if the police are out to get you and you run into a church and claim sanctuary,
mm-hmm.
I can imagine that somewhere in the annals of the Constitution or something like that, the cops can't go into the church. But at the same time, like, what if it's a lynch mob and they're all, you know, they're all Bible reading Catholics and you run into a church and claim sanctuary? Like, why can't they just go in there too?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they respect it more because they're Catholics. You know what I mean? They don't want to break the rules of their own church. I don't think you can have. I love separation of church and state. I'm a strong proponent of that, but that never for me crosses beyond the law.
Right.
You know what I mean? You can't have, it's like when they make drugs illegal, but certain religions that, you know, do shrooms. I mean, that's their excuse. It's their religion, man. You can't touch them. You know, I don't like that. Like
thanks,
you,
Dennis Hopper,
you fucking repeal the law. And not the yeah. you don't make an exclusion for a certain religion.
Right.
You just make that not a law, or you fucking stick to your guns, and no one gets to do shrooms.
Yep.
Next film.
Yeah. Speaking of shrooms, we have the Black Plague. In Isle of the Dead, we have So here's one of the weirdest things about. First off, Isle of the Dead is a film from the 50s, I think.
Okay.
50s or 60s. It's Boris Karloff,
and it's
Boris Karloff of old age.
Right.
And he plays this army general overseas in Greece.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really odd because, like, the army general thing doesn't really play out except for he's, like, a stern...
Right.
Is that his name?
Yeah. It informs...
The Watchdog.
Yeah, Watchdog. It informs his character a little bit.
Yeah.
But that doesn't...
I
just thought it was weird because he wasn't playing a swamp demon.
Yeah, or a monster or somebody with a limp and a...
right, yeah.
Crooked gait.
There's a couple things that make this film kind of interesting and why it's kind of a roller coaster ride for me. I'm sure you feel the same thing. While we're talking about libertarian politics on the show, let's just get into fucking atheism too. So there is a lot of religious commentary in about the first half of this film. It's almost two separate films, right?
There's the whole pagan Hermes, like the bet, I think, is what it was.
Do you have the same level of uncomfortability when you're trying to figure out if a film works on a secular level or if you have to buy into a silly mythology?
No, that happens to me pretty much any time I watch a film.
Right.
Literally any time.
So you don't have that roller coaster ride of like crossing your fingers under your seat that they're going to go, oh, all of this is silly and there's no God and this is just the plague?
Well, I always try to understand every film on a level that makes me identify with it.
Sure.
The second a film forces me to swallow some like life after death or angels or whatever,
right.
I immediately the film loses points. If you look at the films I like my top 10 films, none of them have ghosts. Well, Beetlejuice
doesn't count as a ghost. I guess it sort of does. All right, I'll accept that.
But things like, you know, if you look at horror films that I really like,
right,
all the voodoo, witchcraft, ghosts and demons bullshit, that it cheapens the film because I want to see, you know, I want to see something I can feel is grounded in the same reality that I'm grounded in.
It's the reason, you know, people always criticize us for not doing Japanese horror films.
Yeah.
It's because they're all, you know, not the Japanese ones, but by the time we get them over here, they're all like remakes of a remake of a sequel to a Japanese ghost story. Mm-hmm. And fuck that. But once we get past the religious commentary, which I think is really interesting, and I like a lot of the ideas exchanged there. When this decides to be a horror movie for like the last 20 minutes of it, it's all sound.
Yeah, it's
that's
just
something
loud.
That was
it's
really interesting to me. You know, when you first get that scream, I guess we're not going to spoil anything. So I'll say let's say scream in the box, right? When you first get that scream in the box, it is terrifying. It is so shrill and grating. And it was the first legitimate scare of the evening, mm-hmm. which an event called Music Box Massacre. You expect a lot of things to be terrifying, not just, you know, how the interviews are conducted to be terrifying, but things that actually happen, you know, in the films themselves. And you get a couple other things. I mean, it's all reverb. That's what I'm just big into audio production. Mm-hmm. I really like that it's made terrifying just because everyone sounds like they're in a cave.
Yeah.
You know, just the different screams and the stuff going on at the end of the film. It's really cool. Mm-hmm. I also like that in the end, it's all kind of science.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no BS there, even with all the religious,
right,
you know, rituals and kind of superstitions and charms and stuff aside. It's all science at the end of the day, which especially for a film that old, that's exactly where I want it to be.
I agree.
But then we go to a better place that I didn't know existed.
So Roger Corman's Bucket of Blood is it's a 1-2 punch of hilarity. You have this kind of, I don't want to say retarded, but he's definitely a little slow.
Right.
The lead in the film is a little slow, mm-hmm. And he just wants so badly to be a part of the bigger joke of the film.
Yeah.
Which is the Beat Generation.
Yeah, beatniks, you don't see them in films anymore, no, which is weird. A shame. You really, they've been replaced in our culture by hipsters.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of what happened, which they're just not nearly as funny as the beatniks are.
Well, that's the difference between, like,
there's not enough poetry, I think.
Yeah, there's not enough poetry.
Not enough finger snapping, you know?
And there's not enough awareness.
So Roger Corman, we talked about a little bit back in our Vincent Price episode, I think. Roger Corman adapted a lot of
Edgar Allan Poe.
We have to talk about that, too. Roger Corman adapted a lot of Edgar Allan Poe, which was also a theme of the night because this is like the Poe bicentennial. So
200,000 years old.
Yeah, right. So he did like The Raven and The House of Usher and all these different movies, and he did them with Vincent Price, and he did them really cheap, and they're all really amusing. I thought that was going to be the height of Roger Corman until I saw a fucking Bucket of Blood, because that movie is incredible.
Yeah, it's a
riot. It is so funny. And I think to explain anything from the plot is to spoil it. But give me a couple things without plot elements that you think made the film what it is. Can you do that without plot stuff?
Well, one of the things that I really, really liked is the lead character's artwork. Is that a spoiler to say he has artwork?
Yeah, I think that's safe to mention that okay. He has artwork.
Yeah.
His first piece, let's say, is probably my favorite. I really enjoy that one.
I just like the way they look and how weird. Can't say anything more than that.
No, you really can't. Yeah. It's hard to do spoiler-free shows. That's why we don't do that.
The other thing I really like is one of the other lead characters, the one who's kind of at the forefront of the right, in the club,
right.
In the coffee club there.
Yeah.
And his poetry and just his everything that comes out of his mouth.
So at the time, this is a satire of beatnik culture, right? I mean, it's not.
It's
got to
be. It can't just be.
Okay. Because that was even kind of past that era, wasn't it? I don't know if beatniks were quite in the day of that film. This is what happens when we kind of go off on the show without any previous information.
When we
of
go
what's
off
happening.
On the show with 24 hours of horror behind us.
So a lot of it is the imagery, I guess. The comedy of it is really, really good to me.
The guy who plays the lead, I can't remember his fucking name.
Right.
I used to have it, but he's the guy who's always in the Joe Dante stuff. The guy from Gremlins.
Sure.
He was in Small Soldiers.
Right.
And this is definitely one of his earlier roles.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy is awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody could have played... This is a difficult role.
Yeah,
it's
sure.
a difficult role to play somebody who's that naive.
Right.
And not come off as a total idiot.
Sure.
And you still...
Be
like,
a redeemable character
yeah,
that
the thing
you
is, you go through the
film
sympathizing with this guy for being so, like, out of what he's doing.
Right.
Like, he's out of his element, and all he wants to be is in his element.
Yeah.
And he's just skirting it the whole time.
I think this is probably one of the most fun... Even black and white films that I think I would encapsulate this in all of black and white. If I did like a black and white top five, this would definitely be in there. It's a shame we can't talk more about it because so much of it is heavy plot elements. And I went into this movie knowing absolutely nothing about it. And that's how I think other people should go into it. So unfortunately, that's all we can say. You know, something we didn't talk about that happened right before this was, I don't know if it was the Chicago premiere, but... For me, anyway, I'd never seen this. Hobo with a Shotgun.
Yeah.
So what is Hobo with a Shotgun?
Hobo with a Shotgun is the cutting room floor trailer of Grindhouse.
I think they showed it in Canada or something,
That's
right?
Because that's where it was made.
Okay.
It's a Canadian-made trailer, and it was the little engine that could, hoping to find its
way
sandwiched somewhere between Eli Roth and Rob Zombie and Edgar Wright and Quentin Tarantino
some pretty big
and
names.
Robert Rodriguez.
Right, yeah.
Tag all five of them. But it didn't make the cut in the States. Neither apparently did Grindhouse. But
yeah.
So they showed the trailer. Mm-hmm. Apparently, they've turned it into a full short.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it's goofy. It's a hobo with a shotgun.
I was surprised by the budget toward the end of the trailer because it it looks immediately like a couple kids filmed it with their home DV, camera. Yeah, right. It's a mini DV production. But by the time you get to the end, there's a lot of explosions, really good squib stuff. I was really amused by it, and I'm kind of sad that maybe in 2010, Grindhouse will finally be out in a DVD package together where they actually have the fucking trailers. It's going to be a tragedy when we get to that year and I have to go back and edit this show and none of this shit exists. I'm going to be really fucking sad. So let's go back to this Poe thing a little bit.
Let's go back to Edgar A. Poe.
We had a couple Poe readings, which were pretty good. You should, you know what, I'm just going to leave that open to our audience to kind of Google Music Box Massacre 5 and find out who the presenters were and what happened with the readings. But I found them to be highly amusing.
They were really funny. And that was the first time we ever got a glimpse of our old buddy Stuart Gordon there.
Yeah, Stuart Gordon showed up in a lot. You know, before we do any of this, I don't like to do these when we go to these events and stuff. I like to have, we have an interview, right? It's a really short interview. Usually when people come to these events, it's hard to track them down and talk to them. I got a chance to sit down with Stuart Gordon and just ask him a couple questions that were on my mind when I was over-caffeinated, and, you know, I kind of wanted to talk to him because I'd walk past him in the hall like 3 or 4 times, and he was kind of just hanging out.
Yeah, he just waved. I remember I walked out of the bathroom and passed him, and he just waved to me, and I gave him a thumbs up.
Yeah, I mean, I'd just seen him do an interview for some, like, local Chicago something, Svengoolie fucking bullshit, so I was like, all right, you know, we should probably talk to Stuart Gordon a little bit. And I had a couple things in my mind. So here is something that you will never get on the show again, I promise. But this is just 5 minutes of random questions with Mr. Stuart Gordon. So the first thing I noticed about Reanimator is obviously that it's unrated. I was hoping maybe you could talk a little bit about your decision to do that.
Well, it wasn't my decision, you know, but I'm happy that the distributor decided to do that. It's a brave thing, and it's very seldom done now. And you know, what he could have done, which is what most distributors do, is insist that you have an R-rated movie and that we make trims. But what I think the MPAA would have said is that if we had cut everything that was objectionable, we'd end up with a 12-minute movie.
So at what point in the process do you find out that you're going to be able to go through it unrated?
I think it was a decision that they made towards the end. You know, it really, you know, I think they sent it to the MPAA for their notes, and the MPAA said, there's no way this is ever going to get an R rating.
So that was something that didn't even undergo that process. Were you worried, you know, as you guys moved through the script and as you were shooting it, that there was going to be things that had to be cut later on?
We were very naive.
Yeah.
And we thought that as long as we didn't show full frontal male nudity, that we'd be okay.
Right.
And so we had these things that were called merkins for the actors to wear, which essentially is like a jock strap covered with hair to obscure the fact that, you know, we didn't want to see anyone's, you know, genitals.
Right.
And as it turned out, we ended up not using those things. And there, we finally, at the end of the shooting, we did a scene where the producer was present and he said, I think we'd better use one of those now. And it turned out that the costume designer had thrown them all away because we weren't using them. So he ended up spray painting this guy black.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And in the movie, you know, you still see that this guy, you know, you still see him full frontally, and except it now that his, you know, his junk is black, I guess you'd say. And I've had people ask me, is that what happens when you die? It's like, is it like a banana? It just turns black.
Yeah, that's another one of the things I noticed is you have male and female nudity in this. A lot of times in horror films, it's kind of become the cliche that you don't get male nudity. You think a lot of people are worried about, you know, famously, if you have male nudity, you get a harder rating, or it's harder for your film.
It was something that was in our minds. But that was, you know, the fact that we had 30 gallons of blood in the film didn't seem to make any impression on us.
So this is also a movie that had a very lasting cult appeal. I was wondering if you have any idea, you know, after the time, why it's held up for so long, why it's being shown here tonight, where the cult appeal kind of comes from.
You know, I think what's funny about it, the movie is now 25 years old, which makes it almost an antique.
Right.
And but I think it's still outrageous. I think that there are things about it that people still are kind
pushing
of
pushing boundaries.
Yeah, they're kind of amazed. It makes you, you know, your jaw drop, and you're still, which is, you know, like, I think it's quite wonderful.
So between the different movies being shown here tonight, noticed it originally in The Black Cat, again in Reanimator, and then just in the opening sequence of From Beyond. One of the great taboos of cinema is, you know, you don't kill the pet. You don't seem to have a problem with the small, fuzzy creatures being tormented in your films. I'm wondering if that's an accident or kind of a motif of your work.
Well, you know, I think one of the things I've found out is that people are much more upset about animals being harmed than they are about people. It's interesting, you know, and so in a horror movie, you always got to find ways to sort of push those buttons that really, you know, upset people. And, you know, doing it with animals is a way to do it, as long as you don't really hurt them.
One of the things I think is really great about The Black Cat, we talk about a lot of technical filmmaking on Double Feature. You have your protagonist really go through kind of a battle with this cat about halfway through the film. It looks like that was something that was really hard to shoot. I was wondering if you could kind of talk about how you went forward with that.
Well, it was very hard to shoot The Black Cat because, you know, getting a cat to do anything is really difficult. But we had a wonderful trainer, and we ended up using 7 cats in this movie. Yeah. And what was interesting, you know, we had one-eyed cats and two-eyed cats, and we had cats, you know, each cat had a certain specialty, and it was kind of like, you know, using the right cat for the right job.
So do you have to specifically cast for a one-eyed cat? How does that work?
We did. You know, our trainer went out and looked for them, and, you know, then was able to bring them back and train them. You know, she trained the cats for several, you know, weeks before we started shooting. And, you know, I think it's extraordinary. I, you know, look at that movie, and I just, you know, not sure how she accomplished half of what she did.
Stuart, I want to thank you for coming on the show.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Hopefully we'll get him back when we do, say, Stuck on the show. But so Stuart Gordon showed up. He gave us basically what I didn't realize at the time. He gave us what I thought was ad nauseum a biography of Edgar Allan Poe.
Right.
However, going into the following film, which was Stuart Gordon's The Black Cat, which he did for Masters of Horror, which I hate. But
do you want to talk about Masters of Horror really quick before we launch into this?
So Masters of Horror was this thing. It was a TV production, and Stuart Gordon loves it, and the reason he loves it makes me more apologetic toward it.
Right.
But I hate it. Yeah. Hated it. Yeah. Stuart
Didn't,
Gordon.
Didn't Lucky McKee do one of
Lucky
those,
Lucky McKee
too?
Did one. John Carpenter did one. Toby Hooper did two, I think.
Right.
And Wes Craven, I believe, was involved. Like, it's all these you know, the faces and names of horror who come in and they do 45-minute...
of TV horror films.
45-minute of TV horror films. But Stuart Gordon claims, and who am I to disagree with, Naked Peter Pan, that they gave them complete creative control down to the, like, amount of blood and violence.
Sure.
That's cable TV for you.
Yeah.
I don't like them because I feel like they're bastardizations of these great filmmakers' horror work.
Right. Why should they be constrained to
to 45 minutes on television?
Right.
Granted, it's their own decision. They can make the story and come up with the story. But honestly, I would have liked to see The Black Cat go another 30 minutes.
Right.
You know,
well, and
like,
from the production values I've seen of these, that's really the crippling part. It's not like the stories hold anything back.
Right.
It's not like the gore holds anything back. All that stuff really is there. Just looks really made for TV.
Yeah. And that's just an unfortunate side effect with anything that you're going to get put on TV. Now, that being said, Stuart Gordon's The Black Cat was screened after our little Edgar Allan Poe, we miss you, come back, say hi thing.
Right.
Just
the thank fuck it wasn't a seance. That's all I have to say about that shit.
And this is the first Jeffrey Combs of the evening.
Yeah, yeah.
Jeffrey Combs as Edgar A. Poe.
Yeah.
And you have this fantastic film where everything that Stuart Gordon had previously told you about Edgar Allan Poe's life becomes fantastic background because you don't need any exposition.
I was amazed how much of that detail about Edgar's life kind of came into the short, and especially right in the beginning. You know, a lot of that stuff seems really kind of fantastical, and it's not until Stuart Gordon taps you on the shoulder and says, no, that actually really happened. Mm-hmm. It always reminds me of the South Park thing about Joseph Smith, the Mormon one.
Right.
Which, so South Park did this big kind of expose of the Mormon church, the Mormon faith, and their mythology.
Dum, da, dum, dum, dum.
And no one really got the joke because everyone thought they were just making this shit up and it's kind of weird and lame. So later when they did Scientology, they had to put this is what Scientologists actually believe on the screen because no one got the joke with Mormons. They would think people were just making it up with Scientology. That's how I feel about the Poe thing here. You're kind of like, this shit is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And Stuart Gordon is like, this is what Edgar Allan Poe actually believes. So one thing this does that we've never talked about as of 2009 on this show, you see it a lot more in TV than you do it in film, and you were asking me about it, so I'm going to not give you my answer and then just ask you on the air here. We get this shot where something really violent happens, but then it turns out to just be a daydream. Mm. It's the kind of thing you see, you know, I rewatched Dexter recently, and you see it a lot in there, like, there's maybe it's only once or twice, but he like freaks out and throws things and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe that just happened. And then you see him wake up at his desk.
Yeah. I mean, those moments I like to affectionately and spitefully refer to them as, and then they wake up.
Right. Yeah. Well, I don't know. What's your take on that?
I will always, always, always speak out against and then they wake up.
Yeah.
Because I feel like they're never... First off, let's go back a million years to the first season of the show.
All right.
Where...
Of our show, you mean.
Of our show.
Right.
Where we talk about three-sentence dream theory.
Right.
If you're going to show me someone's dream on TV or in film,
right,
regardless of where you're showing me their dream, first off, I don't care unless I'm in it.
Right.
And
or nudity, I or believe nudity is one of the,
And third, okay, I don't want to, I don't want it to last more than three sentences.
Right.
Like, I'm not involved. I don't see how this applies to the person's life.
Right.
Personally, I don't see how dreams affect anybody's real life, except they wake up frightened.
Right. It's a trick for your audience.
It's a great excuse to do violent, horrendous things that don't affect the plot.
Okay.
Which makes it cheating.
I think as an audience member, I've been thinking about this a lot, and I think I've honed it down to this. The shorter this little fake segment is, the better I feel about
it. Yeah.
If they did this for 45 minutes and then a character woke up, I would be kind of pissed. If they did this for literally like like he gets up and stabs someone in the eye and they jump cut right back to him, then it's perfect. Then I'm so, you know, because there's this level of your audience has been tricked and there's mad. And then there's also this level of it's a joke.
Yeah.
So as long as the joke outweighs the trick, I think generally people feel positive about it. They don't feel like it's a cheat.
I think it works when it's the character being like, this is what I want to do to you right now. Sure. And then it cuts back to him being like, yeah, sure, I'll write you a story.
Right. But it has to be pretty immediate.
Right.
So I tried to get Stuart Gordon to tell me he actually mutilated a cat and he wouldn't do that because I'm amazed with some of there is a scene where the protagonist fights a cat. Right. And so a lot of the stuff that happens between him and the cat, it's pretty brutal and it looks pretty good. I mean, maybe it was just really dark and I just sat through a lot of poetry, so my head was kind of swimming. But I think they really got away with, you know, that's not where the budget was lacking.
Mm.
All the cat stuff came out really, really well.
So did all the coughing up blood.
Yeah, that's what I was going to mention. Aside from the, let's call it the eyeball shot, which is pretty great. The blood
also
over the piano.
Face. I liked Hatchet Face.
Oh, yeah. That was a good one, too. The blood over the piano is gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
I've always liked that image of blood on a keyboard for some reason. I don't know why.
But
it's all this kind of like slow motion stuff, and it's thick, and it's fucking everywhere. It's just really aesthetically pleasing. One of the things I like about Stuart Gordon and stuff we'll see in his films to come. And we'll get back to Stuart Gordon, but we take a break from Stuart Gordon to go into The Brood.
Mm-hmm.
The Brood is done by a filmmaker we have talked about before.
Whose name is David Cronenberg.
So tell me what you love about The Brood before I tell you about the uncomfortable pieces and then tell you that it's totally fine anyways.
What I love about The Brood, let's see. I love the thing. This is something that I've apparently recently discovered that I like about films.
Mm.
Nothing happens in The Brood.
No.
Nothing happens. And that's saying it loosely. There's people dying. There's horrendous things going on. Crazy, violent, creepy creatures.
Right.
All scuttering around this film.
Yeah.
But the story arc doesn't start or end until the final act of the film.
Yeah.
It's kind of, you just kind of have a straight incline and then you go, and here's what's going on.
Yeah. Some of the most memorable David Cronenberg imagery ever.
And the reason that that's powerful and the reason that that works in films like The Brood and films like Rosemary's Baby is what you and I like to call the payoff.
Right.
Is horrendous.
Yeah, it
it's
really is.
Absolutely horrendous. And it's the kind of horrendous where like some movies will punch you in the face with it. And they're like, haha, got you. That was horrendous.
Right.
This movie, it's like it takes a long knife and it's just like, here we go. And it starts stabbing you real slow.
Right.
And it just keeps pushing it in. And you're like, wow, that's painful.
Well, before the knife enters the skin, we have a lot of pop psychology. That's the part about The Brood that always makes me uncomfortable.
Me too.
But then after you watch The Brood and a couple days have passed, you don't remember any of that because maybe you've just blocked it out of your mind. Do you think the weird, bad pop psychology is necessary for the story and for the ending?
Yeah, or could it's got to be.
I
feel like that's the explanation for what's going on.
That's why I give it a pass, because
you have the introduction to the film, which is the guy who starts developing the sores on his body
right
throughout the conversation.
Right. Which is also a really interesting opening for us, too.
And I mean, that is the very beginning of the sentence, which ends with the exclamation point at the end of the film. You know, right.
Cronenberg does that a lot, too. He has these really good opening scenes, which kind of throw you into, or at least give you a piece of the puzzle right away.
Well, they give you the thing that Cronenberg does that I love is that when he's going to suspend your disbelief, he tells you to what degree right away.
Right, right.
You never have to wait till the second or third act of the film to understand how far this film is going to push it.
Right. In case you're one of the few people who haven't seen a David Cronenberg movie, he wants you to know right away what kind of movie you're getting into. He wants you to know you're going to be a little uncomfortable. He wants you to know you're going to be a little uncomfortable, and then it turns out you're going to be really uncomfortable. Right. But I guess that's a good point to talk about our audience, because something I've never experienced with The Brood until I experienced it with this audience is I think a lot of people hadn't seen this.
Yeah.
And they were under the assumption that this was a funny movie.
Funny movie.
So tell me about the audience reaction to this.
The thing about the audience reaction to The Brood is that they laughed.
Yeah.
I remember watching The Brood for the first time alone, and being just incredibly uncomfortable, right. Kind of like checking my body to make sure everything was still okay.
I don't think I even chuckled at the actual jokes in the
right.
film.
But the audience being, you know, being what I would classify under a grindhouse cinema group.
Yeah. And having just gotten off of The Black Cat. Yeah,
they just want, you know, fun gore fest and crazy naked women. That's right. All they're looking for at this point in the night. And unfortunately, The Brood delivers that in the wrong way.
Yeah, and absolutely the wrong way. So this was really amusing for me because about half of the audience had seen this and half hadn't. And maybe, you know, that's a little skewed, but you get the idea. So the half of the audience that hadn't seen this would laugh at things that are supposed to just kind of make you feel awkward because they don't know what mood they should actually be set up for. And then you would hear a slight delay, and then you would hear the rest of the audience laugh at those people, kind of like, you know, they know what's coming, and they're kind of amused that, hey, this audience doesn't really know what's going to happen. So by the time you get to the end, and the end is fucking disturbing and twisted and whatever, I was so pumped for the second that there's that kind of, I guess you'd call it a reveal in the sense of, you know, the
literacy.
I guess that too. But I mean, in as much as we're talking about this experiment of the screening audience here, I really desperately wanted to see, you know, it was almost like a practical joke for me at that point, because here every once in a while, this audience would giggle and I would kind of turn to someone next to me and be like, really? Is that really funny? What's happening there? And so, you know, our whole row had seen this thing and we were all kind of snickering to ourselves like, oh man, it's going to happen, you know? And the point when the actual sort of reveal comes and the audience realizes what's been going on this whole time and that this is actually a terribly disturbing film and not a laugh out loud riot, it was one of the more awkward sounds I've ever heard a body of people emit. It was really amusing.
Speaking of bodies of people, I think it's safe to move back into Stuart Gordon's, what I would consider Stuart Gordon's masterpiece.
Look at your wonderful transitions.
Granted, I haven't seen, there's about three Stuart Gordon films I haven't seen, Space Truckers included, but Reanimator, Jeffrey Combs' crowning role as far as the horror world is concerned, H.P. Lovecraft's like final homecoming to the cinema screen,
right?
And Stuart Gordon making a goddamn bright green movie,
right? Yeah, Jeffrey Combs showed up previously in this show. Do you remember the last Jeffrey Combs movie we did? I'll give you a hint. There was a talking hand puppet and that guy from Robot Chicken. The Attic Expeditions.
Oh, the film
you're forgetting about. Where he actually kind of plays a role that's homage to the Reanimator.
He plays Herbert West.
Yeah, right. Dr. Eck, I believe. Or is it X? No, it's Eck.
Eck, yeah.
Yeah, this is a movie that really, really runs with its premise. And that is fantastic.
Yeah.
So often in movies like this, you have to introduce the audience to that kind of premise. And there's still a period of that in Reanimator. But it's fairly brief.
Yeah, very brief.
Once you get the premise, you kind of go everywhere with it. You explore every area that you can with it, which is something that I really give Stuart Gordon credit for, because he said when he was sort of introducing the movie that they had these, you know, six short stories or whatever.
Miniseries, basically.
And they were trying to figure out how much do you put in and how much don't you. And you can see that kind of control all over the film where they kind of go, well, this would be a totally different story, but let's just pack that into the film too. So this film is so packed with content, and it makes it so rewatchable, and I think that's what adds to a lot of its cult value.
The other thing that adding six different stories into the film is it makes it so that there's never a dull moment. The film is constantly skimming the cream off of these six stories instead of fodder and filler from like one long version.
Well, it's beat after beat after beat. You're constantly moving to your next plot point, and you have no time in between. You're always trying to kind of play catch up with the characters.
Yeah. And it's violent as fuck. It's gory as fuck. It's all puppetry and practical effects.
Right.
And there's a visual pun, which is, as Stuart Gordon put it, I can't take the term visual pun. I believe that was his writer, but it's absolutely, that was the moment that what we got for The Brood, that was what they were actually waiting for. This part, the visual pun of Reanimator.
Everybody knows the scene when you've actually seen it, but it's the scene towards the end with the
Dr.
woman,
Hill. With Dr. Hill and the woman.
So, I mean, I guess you start with that exploration. You introduce people to the concept. That's your first fucking beat right there. And then once people have grasped that, they've understood it, and they're going with it, the hyper-charismatic Jeffrey Combs
absolutely
just guides you through thing after thing after thing. You're always kind of going, well, now that we... The premise is that you can reanimate the dead, right? It's fucking Reanimator, all right? So once we've accepted that you can reanimate the dead, we go everywhere we possibly can.
As long as within
a single story, right. I mean,
as long as your lead character is developed as the type of person who only wants to find results,
right?
You never have to stop. Yeah. You never have to have a character that goes, is there really any moral implications here? Is this getting dangerous? Where along the lines do we draw the stopping line?
Well, that's the mad scientist.
Exactly.
Right?
You have Jeffrey Combs, who plays Herbert West, who all he wants to do is understand and get results and learn and become well known for what he's doing.
Well, and that's why the mad scientist is such a great role and kind of a cliche in film, because it opens up all these doors for you. I've never seen the mad scientist taken to the degree that it is in Reanimator. It has no humility, you know what I mean? It goes anywhere it wants to, and that's the joy of that film. Also seeing the stuff they don't, I haven't seen the Reanimator sequels at this point in time. I'll totally see them. But where the movie chooses to end, it's something I kind of wanted to talk to Stuart Gordon about, but I thought maybe we'll cover it on another show or something. I think it ends in a really, really interesting place where it could have obviously continued on very easily. It could have done a lot of different things with the ending, but it leaves you wanting more. It leaves you basically wanting to hit rewind and watch the entire film again. Mm-hmm. That's exactly, especially with a film like Reanimator, which is a lot about pushing people's buttons. It's about gore. It's about nudity. It's about horror. Mm-hmm. It's about classic horror elements.
What it is.
You want to make people fucking go, hey, let's watch that again.
Right. So I think before we move into From Beyond, I think From Beyond is yet another Stuart Gordon film. And
just
I think
keeps
this is
happening.
This is a good time to once again talk about the lineup and the choosing of the films.
Right.
So first off,
Let it be
said that neither Eric nor myself dislike Stuart Gordon.
Right.
In fact, I love him as a filmmaker.
Huge fans.
And all the films shown, I like. I don't want to make this sound like, oh my God, stop showing bad films.
Right.
But when you go to a film festival where you're watching 13 films back to 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 back for 24 hours, how much of one director can you take?
Well, the other question, I mean, I could watch Stuart Gordon all day. I could watch 13 Stuart Gordon movies. I think he's a great guy. The bigger question for me is every time you insert a film, you also eliminate potential for other films.
Right, exactly.
There's a lot of other things that could have been crammed into The Massacre if we didn't have three Stuart Gordon films. I mean, I kind of get where it's coming. Stuart Gordon's a Chicago filmmaker. He's a guy who's been probably one of the most successful directors from this city.
Absolutely.
He's a guy who loves this city, and he's a guy who also kind of bumbled around in the lobby till like 4 in the morning. I mean, how could you not love this guy? He's got these great stories. Once you already have him there, to talk to, you want to explore more of his work. Unfortunately, that's just not the way you should pair up 13 movies.
Right.
We want to fit as much of the horror spectrum in the... I mean, if I were putting together one of these events, I would even throw in stuff I didn't necessarily like, stuff from different ranges of, the horror spectrum.
You try to make it something
for
everyone.
You want it diverse. Right,
Something for everyone, not... something for Stuart Gordon fans.
Right. Thankfully, we're Stuart Gordon fans, so we have no complaints here. However, a lot of people may not be Stuart Gordon fans, and so what do you do about
that? And if you're not a Stuart Gordon fan, From Beyond is not for you.
Okay, so I have to admit something to our audience here, and this is the first time this has ever happened on this show. Obviously, like I said, I was trying to track down Stuart Gordon as I was playing Find Stuart Gordon in the lobby. Mm-hmm. I missed like an hour chunk of From Beyond. Never before in double feature history have I like missed the film we're supposed to fucking talk about. But I see the beginning and, you know, it's setting you up for some crazy sci-fi shit, some very, you know, Dead Z-esque material. And then I take a little break and I go wander off and talk to Stuart Gordon for a while. And I come back and literally the most insane shit I possibly can see. I mean, I wish I could spoil it because it's just so fucking funny what I come back to. But what happened
The thing about From Beyond is the Black Cat is kind of Stuart Gordon for everyone.
Yeah.
And Reanimator is Stuart Gordon for horror fans.
Sure.
From Beyond is Stuart Gordon for Stuart Gordon fans.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Combs once again plays the mad scientist. However, he's not the maddest of scientists.
Right.
He's actually working with another scientist. And the whole premise of the film is that they create this resonator that stimulates the pineal gland and essentially kind of brings out a sixth sense. Mm-hmm. Not like bullshit dead people sixth sense, but like...
What a twist.
It gives you this kind of sensibility of what's going on around you.
Uh-huh.
You know, they build this resonator, it works, and all this...
Also, tuning forks are involved.
And hijinks ensue.
Right.
This resonator happens, this bad shit happens, and you have Jeffrey Combs and the cast of Reanimator, almost character for character, back in this film, plus a very, very important role, and one we don't get to talk about enough because we just don't get a hit on his films enough.
Ken Foray, right?
Ken Foray. Yeah.
Ken Foray we've seen on the show in what films?
I believe the we touched on him with Dawn of the Dead, but he was also in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3.
Mm.
And if you don't remember our Texas Chainsaw Massacre conversation, you just stay tuned.
Yeah, we'll get to that too. There's not anything I can really say about From Beyond because I fucking missed most of it. And
it's fun. Terrible. It's not as fun as Reanimator, but if you like Stuart Gordon, it's definitely in the top three.
You know, I ran into a couple of people at the massacre, and this is another reason I love the Music Box and going to see films with an audience. I don't always buy into the concept, as I've spoken about before and we'll speak about again, of this is the way films are meant to be seen, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But seeing films in a audience packed of 800 people who you have to talk to between the films and in the lobby and outside and when you're getting food and when you're doing tickets or whatever, you get instant feedback from so many different types of people about the film. I ran into a lot of people just talking in the lobby who liked From Beyond more than Reanimator.
Because it's crazier.
Yeah, it just does that for them. And I really enjoy seeing... I don't know if I've ever seen films with more than 800 people like this. I mean, this is such a huge theater, and there's so many people there, and there's so much instant feedback being thrown around. I really like that experience. That makes even less sense to me when I haven't seen From Beyond, but that's fine.
Mm-hmm. All right, so now we reach this moment in our night where we finally get to what last year was the... Well, actually, last year they premiered Midnight Meat Train.
Right.
This year, we had a premiere, but it fell in the same slot as Dead Alive.
Yeah, it was pretty late in the evening.
It was the midnight film.
Yeah.
It was apparently the zombie film.
Yeah.
It was this Canadian masterpiece, called Pontypool.
Yeah, Pontypool was the single film I was not excited for before the... you even heard it back when we talked about Music Box Massacre 4. You're naming off the films, and you're like, oh, hey, Pontypool, it's this. I'm like, don't care.
Mm-hmm.
All you have to go by on the Music Box website is the screenshots, and it's like some dude in a fucking cowboy hat.
Screaming.
And I'm like, this does not... I'm not in the least bit interested in this. They had a couple flyers for it, too. It just wasn't doing anything for me. So I think that the elements of advertising for Pontypool there were terrible. So I'm going to give you my pitch for Pontypool here. This is an incredibly enigmatic film. It's a puzzle piece film, as we talk about here on the show, about a guy at a radio station. It's about somebody who essentially does what we're doing right now.
Yeah.
I mean, he talks to people.
Except there's more important things going on outside.
Right, yeah. And more important things probably going on inside the studio as well. But he's got a radio gig. He's like a morning, what do you call that?
Morning madhouse DJ.
Well, I don't want to call it that. I hesitated calling it that because maybe they just don't have those in Canada. I didn't listen to the radio at all when I was in Canada, but maybe those don't exist there, which would be really cool. But yeah, it's a guy who does morning radio, and he kind of talks about the events of the day, gives his crazy opinions, and then they go to the dude in the chopper. I mean, that's just kind of how this works. What makes Pontypool an incredible film is that there is an event that happens close to the studio, within a couple kilometers of the studio, and none of the major news outlets are covering it. They can't get information about it on their Canadian equivalent of the CB radio. No one knows anything. So they get one or two little details about this, and they want to break the story. So news organizations actually start kind of coming to them, and they're trying to figure out. They don't leave the studio, really. I mean, that's the whole premise.
You never see outside of the studio.
Yeah, that's the premise of the whole thing.
You see Grant going to work.
Yeah, right.
And once he enters the studio, you have no outside.
That's it. It's the studio. And so you're trying to put together the pieces of what's happening outside based on what he's saying, the calls they're getting. It's a movie I mentioned before that I like audio production, and it's a movie that made me sad immediately because I was listening to his voice and thinking how our podcast doesn't sound like right. that, and it, you know, it made me cry inside. A lot of it is about audio techniques. A lot of it is stuff that they do with the voices when they do stuff with the looping a little bit later on. It's really creepy. Some of the phone calls, a lot of it is audio stuff, and you always kind of feel warm and safe in the studio with these people. It doesn't give you the usual, you know, terrifying level of uncomfort until they sort of reveal the gimmick halfway through, and then you realize anything could happen. And you're hanging on every fucking syllable of every word these people are saying, and it's just a beautiful device. This is something that I would say, I'm going to qualify the statement here, and you tell me if you agree with this. I'm going to say that this is a movie literally everyone who can buy the premise will enjoy.
Yeah, absolutely. Right?
I mean, if you can, there is a point where you have to accept what this is a story about. Again, to gauge what I overheard from the audience there, it sounded like everyone fell into one of two camps. You were either in the 99 percentile that loved this film because it's a fucking brilliant piece of art, or you were in the 1% of people who were like, come on, so-and-so, you expect me to believe that? So that's it. Once it happens, you just have to accept it or you get out. And if you can accept it, this is a crazy fucking good film.
It's absolutely fantastic.
I'd say we should do this on the show. Oh, we should do this definitely. And we should do Reanimator both, on the show at some point.
Not necessarily together.
Maybe we should do them together as the... No? Okay. No. You're vetoing
neither,
that idea here
neither
now.
Neither film deserves to be paired with the other.
All right. So when you when this airs in 2010 and you see that four episodes ago we did Reanimator and Pontypool, you will know that I crushed Michael. Yeah. The one other thing I wanted to mention is this is a film that I had the impression would really stick with me. Has this kind of stuck with you? Are you still wondering about this, thinking about
now a week after
the massacre?
The film, it's a question mark. It's going, hey, can you figure me out?
Yeah, right. And all throughout the film, too. Mm-hmm. And you can, you know, we did this differently. You made the choice to, as you often do with these films, to try and figure it out before the film gave it to you. And I just kind of rolled with it. And I think at the end, neither of us really had all of the elements.
The film never gives it to you.
Yeah, right. One of the brilliant things it does is kind of leave the answer to everything buried within the film. So you have to watch it again and again. I cannot wait to watch this for a second, third, and 25th time. So another blunder I have to bring up as we roll into the next film, which I guess we just, it's intervention time, right? This is one of those movies where not only the so-called scene after the credits, but the credits themselves are very important in giving you more details about what happened in a sort of Dawn of the Dead, Zack Snyder style. Sure. Our MC chose to yell on the overhead over the credits of the film, which are very talky and you need to listen closely to understand, to let people know that they should stay around for a scene at the end of what the fuck was going on with this guy? We shouldn't even mention his name because I'm sure this douchebag Googles himself all the time, so I don't want to give him that. But what the fuck, man?
The thing is, like, I can see that maybe it was one of those nights where he had a microphone or a megaphone or something, and he was just like, I'm going to use this the whole night.
Yeah.
And the thing
you couldn't get him away from it.
Yeah, he would.
Here's the example of this, right? The hyper irony example is that this guy would get on the megaphone during the opening credits of each film he would start before the opening credits, but continue through them to tell people that they shouldn't talk.
Yeah.
I mean, does he not understand the word irony?
Yeah.
Like, how do you talk through the first minute of a film to tell people that they shouldn't talk, they should turn off their phones, they should not Twitter, and he's so fucking ridiculous about it. and then to talk over the end credits of Pontypool to tell people they should be listening, yeah, and that they should wait around till the end, as if that's even the piece that matters. It's just so fucking boneheaded. I can't even get over it. It was just really groan-inducing at the massacre, and I think that's why a lot of people left with really sad faces instead of the happy, yeah, faces they should have.
I had like a straight line mouth.
But it was also part of his choice to bring Dark Knight of the Scarecrow, yeah, as a film, and that's why the intervention just has to happen now. Because what the fuck, Dark Knight of the Scarecrow? What is this movie doing here?
So Dark Knight of the Scarecrow, like, it's possible that it was chosen because the director showed up.
Right.
And the director showed up, and it was nice of him to show up at, yes, fucking 3 a.m.
Yeah.
And he had a lot of insight, and he knew... The thing about this director that I can definitely comment on, mm-hmm, he knew what his film was.
Right.
He knew more than any director that I can really recall giving an interview, you know, right, that I've heard speak about their film. He knew shot for shot, word for word, scene for scene, actor for actor, what his film was about, what it was, and where it happened and why, and all the W's and H's and question marks about the film.
Well, because no one except the fans of the most obscure films are even going to have any fucking clue what this, right, is. This is a movie for, you know, don't have cable, don't have internet, then this might be the film for you.
Yeah.
This is a film from 1981.
On CBS, right?
Yeah, it aired as a TV movie on CBS.
Yeah, the week before Halloween or something.
And in its own right, and it got airings, you know, past that, and it's gained a little bit of a cult appeal, mm-hmm, I mean, especially for a TV film,
why.
It's
a groundbreaking TV film. That's
right,
what I
right.
mean, like, that we're talking about a film in 1981, slashers kind of came to fruition around, you know, the mid to late 70s with Black,
right,
Christmas. Like, Jason's still a baby, Michael Myers is still a,
right,
baby,
right,
Freddy's not even around yet,
right, so it's bringing a lot of that to TV is what you're,
yeah,
saying.
Yeah, well, it's pulling the same tricks, like,
right,
it's not necessarily less violent, it's not necessarily cornier, stupider, or simpler,
right,
it's a goddamn slasher movie on CBS in,
yeah,
1981,
right. And so it's great to look at for that. And we're going to try and do that. I don't want to sound like I'm down in the film.
It would be a fantastic film if it weren't in The Massacre.
Okay. But
I think we would have so much more to say about it.
And I think the audience reaction is really telling of that, too. You know, you had a lot of people who... This thing is sandwiched. And this is what I mean about this fucking lineup. It's just the most terrible idea of all time. This thing is sandwiched between the art house Canadian, you know, semi-horror, intellectually packed thriller that is Pontypool. After Pontypool, we just wanted to leave. It was like,
yeah,
this is not.
And I heard
get
other
any
people
better.
In the lobby saying the same thing.
Yeah, right.
I remember a guy, and I can quote. And if you're this guy and you happen to listen to our show,
doublefeatureshow@gmail.com.
But he said, "I feel like I'm not allowed to watch any more films."
Yeah, right, right. That's about what it is. You have this feeling of awe, and where do you go from there? But they chose to go with Dark Knight of the Scarecrow, and after that, and we'll get to this, but after that, we got Texas Chainsaw
2.
I mean, yeah, Texas Chainsaw 2. This is the perfect example of how not to set up a movie marathon. That's all we can really offer people as to our specific skill set.
Yeah.
Because we don't actually make film. We don't work in Hollywood. We don't know anything. But what we do know is putting two films back to back. This is not how you put 13 movies back to back. This is how you punish the filmmaker who agreed, mm-hmm, to show up for this. Because people are like booing and hissing at this. And the only time that it is appropriate to boo at Dark Knight of the Scarecrow is when they invoke the supernatural at the end, and our little sect of atheists in the theater all booed at it, which I really, really enjoyed. But people just aren't feeling this thing because of where it's placed, and because you don't want to throw a TV film from the 80s up against these other
behemoths,
huge guns.
Film.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the mood is wrong. The audience is not going to interpret it for what it is. The only thing that saved this, we would be on this show. Honestly, I mean, if you can give me an honest answer to this, I think you're probably going to agree. We would be totally ripping on this if the director hadn't shown.
Yeah,
it.
I would agree.
He's the only one who put this in perspective for us.
He was. And first off, he was a redeeming person.
Sure.
And he was humble.
He wasn't Joseph Zito.
Yeah.
If he was Joseph Zito, we would still be bagging on this.
The
film.
Thing about this guy is he walks in and he goes, "Now listen, this film was a film that I made, and it aired on CBS in 1981." 2 years in a row on the biggest horror movie week.
Right.
This is an achievement. And without making any of us feel like jerks, he was like, "This is a bigger achievement than most of you will achieve."
Right, yeah.
And he's like, "Now it's not Tobe Hooper's Texas Chainsaw."
Sure. Well, and he talked about how, you know, Tobe went on to do Texas Chainsaw and start the chainsaw genre, and he started the scarecrow
killer
genre.
Scarecrow.
Right. Which I thought was really amusing. But he's right. I mean, for as much as killer scarecrow is a genre, and more so kind of paving the way. I mean, somebody had to do it, but he was the guy who did it to bring these sort of horror made for TV films, which is a big we know it's not the best industry, but just look at the Black Cat and Masters of Horror. A lot of horror exists on television, especially the Sci-Fi Channel, and we talk all the time about these lazy Sunday afternoon horror movies.
Sure. Like Gremlins.
That no one would have, maybe not so with Gremlins as far as no one having seen it, but there's a lot of movies we do on the show people wouldn't have seen if it were not for the TV market for horror films, and a lot that wouldn't even be made. I mean, Masters of Horror is something that, you know, Dark Knight of the Scarecrow kind of paved the way for. It said, hey, there's definitely an audience for bringing something lower budget, but still, you know, high elements of horror, still keeping all that intact and putting it, you know, on the small screen, so to speak. But no one got any of that. What people got was, why is this next to Texas Chainsaw? Get this off the screen and bring on some Texas Chainsaw.
And so they did.
I'm not even saying that it doesn't have to appear in the massacre. Maybe if we had done this like first. You know what I mean?
Do it earlier.
Don't do it at 3 a.m. when we're kind of losing people and it's sleepy time.
Once you get past the midnight film, every film after the midnight film has to just be a fucking violent gore riot.
You cannot
go shorter than that. And made for TV is never your violent gore riot route.
No, it's
what is your violent gore riot route is when you pull up Bill Moseley with a metal plate in his head and fucking Dennis Hopper dual wielding chainsaws. That is where you want to go at 4 a.m.
So we covered this before, and here's all I need to say about it, and you can take this for wherever you want. But we sounded really hard about Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 in our Texas Chainsaw Killapalooza. That's because the Texas Chainsaw Killapalooza was the wrong format to watch Texas Chainsaw 2 in. In the same way we just ragged on the massacre.
Probably the case with I'm going to say this to you because I've always advocated the film, but also the third film. I think if you watched it in its own, you know, independence, it would be better. The rest, I think, are still trash.
Yeah, right. That's probably true. Sure. Well, you have pretty much the fourth, which is. And they do these weird things. We don't need to talk about Texas Chainsaw.
First one, I don't want to knock the first film. I mean, the first film, it goes without saying, is iconic, but it's
iconic and it's an art house slasher film.
But it doesn't
film.
Pack the punch.
Yeah, well, the
it
second
doesn't
one...
It doesn't pack the massacre punch.
Right, the second one brings the ridiculous to an all new level. Mm-hmm. I mean, the first one I wouldn't even call a ridiculous film.
Right.
It's, you know, it's a you can pair it with fucking Silence of the Lambs, you know what I mean? But the second one goes in a totally different direction, and it's the same creator. And, it's just a really odd piece of cinema, so at the time, we were a little uncomfortable with it on the show. However, it was just as amazing at the massacre as we thought it would be. And if you haven't seen Texas Chainsaw, watch it with movies like, you know, Maximum Overdrive and not movies like Texas Chainsaw 1.
Absolutely. Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, we were really harsh on it the first time through, but I will stand by here proudly and say that it's fantastic and it's a riot and... It did so little wrong.
Yeah,
that
we
didn't like. For some reason, we couldn't give it that when we did it the first time. But it does so much right and so little wrong.
Right.
That it's definitely worth a viewing just independently of its series.
And seeing that with an audience and seeing the reactions and stuff,
I got yelled at.
You did actually. You were someone told you to be less enthusiastic about the film.
I was.
It's kind of a buzzkill.
I believe it was right before Chop Top starts screaming Nomland, or maybe no, it was Bring It Down. It was Bring It All Down. I was waiting for Bring It All Down, and Dennis Hopper finally screams his Bring It All Down, and I lost my shit, and then I got told to be less enthusiastic because people were trying to sleep.
So in the Black Sabbath-y kind of area of the massacre now, we have Blood Feast.
Yeah, except the Black Sabbath-y area last year, everybody was making funny jokes, and this year you were just a zombie in a seat.
Yeah, but also people were kind of falling asleep, or I think it was the film before where everyone was asleep, and I turned around several times hoping to get the same zombie effect as the year before, and no one was asleep. Everybody was pretty awake and into this, which made me feel bad because I was the most sleepy person in the entire audience. So I watched this movie. I absorbed the film. I'm not sure I could actually tell you what happened in the film. I will be completely honest. I was 100% awake through the entire film. And once I knew that that had come to its end, you know, I had to deal with that situation. But I made it all the way to the credits. And I couldn't actually laugh because my body was shutting down. But I did really enjoy this film.
Yeah.
This is Herschel Gordon Lewis.
The Gore King.
Yeah. You know, he did Wizard of Gore. We talked about, actually, we didn't even mention... the original, but we talked about 2001 Maniacs, the Robert Englund film. You know, he'd done 2000 Maniacs, which is also a great film, But one, after you see 2001 Maniacs, it's kind of the same film.
Yeah.
2001 Maniacs, something that that movie did so well is embody the elements of the original. It's still the same kind of, it's in that that genre we like so much of, you know, Cabin Fever and, or really even Hatchet, the old school American mm-hmm. horror stuff kind of falls into that, where it's a lot of celebration. It's a lot of, hey, we love the blood. We love the gore. We love the crazy dialogue or the what the fuck stuff. We love the nudity. All of these great elements that that happen in that original stuff, and it kind of strips away the pretension. That's who I thought Herschel Gordon Lewis would be going into this, because I'd never seen one of his films, and, right. and now I'm going through all of them because I fucking love this stuff. But I was worried, as he keeps getting called, you know, the king of gore, that it was going to be more pretentious stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm seeing so much of that right now. I just want fun. But he is the origins of like old school American horror, right?
That's that's why films like
Cabin Fever, like you have to look back. Anytime we do any of that like splatter stuff on the show, I mean, that is Herschel Gordon Lewis, and he was doing it so well back then.
Absolutely. So Blood Feast is this thing. Herschel Gordon Lewis, like, he doesn't have a rule book. His rule book is pick a story that I can lend as much violence to as possible.
Sure.
And then make it both enjoyable and terrifying.
Right.
And this film is about, it's a lot about Egypt. It's kind of weird.
Yeah.
There's a serial killer. I mean, the title is what it is, surprisingly. Right. And there's this lead guy with creepy eyes, which kind of makes the film for me.
Yeah.
There's moments that you laugh, and there's moments that you're uncomfortable, sure. and it all ends with a garbage truck.
Something that's probably the most interesting about this film to me is I usually like when people play it straight in movies, even when the movie is something so like crazy and out there. I want to see people playing it straight. That's just funnier to me. But all of the people in this film kind of get the joke. All of the dialogue is delivered in a way that's really kind of, yeah, you're making the face at me right now.
Yeah.
There's a lot of winking at the camera, you know, but that totally works. It's 100%. You want the people to be with you in this film. I'm not exactly sure why that is and why I enjoy that here more than playing it straight. If everyone was playing it straight, I don't think I would enjoy this nearly as much.
That's probably the case.
But you get that in a lot of Herschel Gordon stuff, and we need to pack more of that on the show too, because I think that stuff is great.
Fantastic. Maximum Overdrive.
So this may be where our only disagreement comes in, but
it's it's going to be a light disagreement.
I think we both enjoyed the film, but for different reasons.
Yeah,
this happens a lot when you or I give each other movies, especially when you give me old 80s stuff.
Yeah,
where I enjoy it because of how terrible it is. Yeah. I mean, is that the feeling you get from this film, or you think there's more there?
No, this film I think is bad. I mean, I don't love Maximum Overdrive. What I love,
Stephen King directed it. Yeah. We should hit on that first. Yeah. He calls this his moron movie, a movie he made for complete morons.
And that's
he has easily, a very cynical point of view about this.
Easily the case, right. Absolutely the right. case. But what I loved about this film, and that's the thing, is like because it was the first scene with the fucking drawbridge.
Yeah, yeah.
So funny.
Yeah.
It's just like.
There's a lot going on in that
the
scene.
The drawbridge is just stuff falling in slow motion right. into the water.
AC/DC.
AC/DC flying watermelons, people crashing through windows, and it goes on and it keeps going.
Right.
And then it's over, and the film kind of just reduces itself to cars driving themselves.
Yeah, it's the characters in this that kind of make me down about it, and that's really the only thing. I mean, these characters, you grow to hate every
Absolutely.
One of them.
Yeah,
and I think
you start rooting for the trucks.
Yeah, you really do. And I understand that effect you want to have, but I mean, if I even hated some of the characters in a charismatic way, but I just hated looking at them.
Mm-hmm.
I hated being with them. I hated being around them. I didn't like the fucking kid. It's just like, get me away from these characters. None of them have any kind of redeeming qualities to them. As I'm watching the film, I felt like Stephen King wasn't with his audience. He was kind of mocking his audience.
Yeah.
He was sort of like, oh, people don't need, you know. Whereas we talk about Zack Snyder being someone who's like, this is what the audience wants. I'm going to put this here. Yeah. I want the audience to enjoy this. Stephen King is more like, these idiots, they don't need real characters. I'm just going to give them these characters. So I think if the characters actually took this seriously or more, were maybe thicker or more well drawn out, I would have liked it more. But you do have some really ridiculous shit in here. The truck filling montage is one of the most ridiculous things that happened in the entire massacre.
Absolutely.
I don't get the whole, like, you know, there is an element of like suspension of disbelief here where they have to make this split decision whether or not to fill up the trucks because the trucks are running out of gas. And they do it because this like army gun on a
table,
a wheel platform is like trying to, So they do this thing where they're like, oh, we got to fill the trucks up because this guy could just call in napalm at any, like...
Yeah, well, because he could Morse code.
Right, yeah, right. What the fuck is that about? Do you fill up the trucks? I mean, why fill up
the
trucks?
No, you don't fill up the trucks.
No, that doesn't make any sense,
You go
right?
down into the basement.
Yeah.
You go down.
You leave, or you attack the... Here's the thing, is this gun is on a rotating platform. I mean, it's not like it can, move or point at anything. You just crawl over to it and knock it over, and then it's done. Yeah. I mean, what the hell? The other thing that I don't like at all about this film is the ending of the film.
Yeah.
The title card with the space aliens and the talk about not respecting your audience.
Well, the thing about that sucks is it's just one of those things where you're like, oh man, all these trucks are alive, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, we could have been showing you this alien thing,
right?
But instead the Green Goblin truck was the bad guy.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. It almost teases you with this film could have been about something else. But what it actually, the reason it's actually there, again, is because I think Stephen King is like, my audience, I don't know, maybe they'll want... He doesn't know what he's doing as a director at all. He has no clue. He went on to never direct anything ever again. I'm pretty sure he hated his directing experience, and that shows here. But it's like, oh, maybe people want to know at the end what... We never really told them what the trucks do. Yeah. I don't know, space alien. Or it's even more ridiculous. It's like there was a UFO, but luckily it was shot down by a Russian satellite that had
satellite.
A laser. Right, that had a laser beam and a cannon mounted on it or something. But it does add to this being a wonderful, wonderful failure. I mean, you want your wonderful failure to tell you at the end.
You wanted it about this time in the morning.
Yeah, that's exactly where you want it. So... before we move into Carrie, I have another double feature confession here.
Oh, no.
So I mentioned at the end of the Herschel Gordon Lewis movie, really fucking tired. And longtime listeners of this show will note my ongoing struggle with the drug that is caffeine.
Mm-hmm.
But I had been, this was back when, during the great 2009 Awesome Start update.
Yeah.
So I'd been programming for weeks straight. You and I had just gotten out of a block schedule experiment.
That was a nightmare.
And so I was just so not ready for this marathon. And I thought, you know what? I'll take a bunch of the free Monster Energy drinks that are in the lobby. Really hope those were free because I just drank them all without asking anyone. And about this time of the night, I went into some kind of jittery spasms and my body was not having it. And so I had to make this choice to puss out on the marathon. I was like, you know what? Here's what I'm going to do.
See, I had already set the precedent for myself.
Yeah, you did.
I'm allowed to leave
you do
before
this every
the last
year.
Film.
I don't know how you get away with
this. Because the last film is stupid.
Yeah, you're just always
last year was The Exorcist, 2 years ago, I guess.
Right.
Now, in the future,
right.
it was The Exorcist, and I was like, The Exorcist is stupid, I'm leaving, and then I heard that this year it was Carrie, and I'm like, Carrie's stupid, I'm leaving.
Don't compare Carrie to The Exorcist. That's not something that should happen.
That's
we'll
true.
Get to that, but first, my admission, if I can just get all of this off my chest here. So I decided that I was going to just give up after...
Max Overdrive.
It was before that.
Oh, Blood Feast.
Just going to give up after Blood Feast. I was going to go home. I still wanted to see the films, but there was no reason to watch these films with this dying, tired audience. I was just going to go home, acquire the films, and watch them in the morning. So I watched Maximum Overdrive and Carrie laying in bed at about 2 p.m. the next day. And let me just tell you that it was the absolute right decision to make. So Carrie gets a lot of crap. So I'm going to defend Carrie
gets a lot of crap, but I think it gets more praise.
Does it?
Absolutely.
That's possible, too.
Carrie is one of the most classic horror films of all
time.
Well,
okay, so here's the thing, is I think it gets a lot of crap and is also well-recognized. And I think those two elements, if you watch Carrie, make total sense.
Yeah.
You know why everybody knows about Carrie, refers to Carrie, and also why it gets a ton of shit. For a horror movie, this is really interesting because all of the horror is at the end.
Yeah.
So putting it in the massacre is really the triumphant ending. We're going to give you a break from Maximum Overdrive. We're going to walk through what's going on in this film. And at the end is where all of the horror comes in. As I was watching it for the first time, I was like, how is this at the Music Box? I don't understand, the horror of this film. Obviously, from Super Bisto, I knew what was going to happen at the end of this film. Thank you for that spoiler, Rob Zombie. I wish I knew a movie that Rob Zombie was about to watch so I could in turn spoil it for him, that bastard. But the whole time leading up to it, there's just no horror elements to it. And so, okay, so I'll get all the nonsense out of the way that people hate. The movie is gimmicky. It has a gimmicky end. There's a lot of split frame and hexavision where it's bug eyes or whatever, which we mentioned Super Bisto. I mean, they make a gag about it in there, but it is the end of Carrie.
Yeah.
I mean, down to the T. Yeah. They really hit a lot of
with the
stuff
sound
there
and everything.
And there's stuff in that ending that really works and is really iconic too. I mean, once everything is there's going to be Carrie spoilers in this. I'm sorry. I'm going to spoil Carrie. I have to, otherwise we can't have anything redeeming to talk about it because it's all at the end. So if you, whatever, Carrie, haven't seen it, bye, see you later. Or fast forward 27 minutes when I get done with my Carrie rant. The ending needs more blood and more fire, because when she is covered in blood and things are just lighting on fire everywhere, it is awesome.
That's the remake. The remake is more blood, more fire.
Is there a remake of Carrie?
Oh, yeah, with Angela Bettis from May.
Oh, no, I didn't even know that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to see that. Isn't there a Carrie 2 as
There's
well?
Carrie 2, The Rage, is kind of, it's silly.
Yeah, is it?
Yeah.
It's
about how she's learned to repress her power.
Oh, yeah, that's not something I need to... Well, you're missing the other piece of the Carrie franchise, which is in Jason.
Oh, right.
Which I guess is unofficial.
Unofficial Carrie.
But yeah, the fire and blood stuff really, really works. It's very cool. But we do get more gimmicks after that. I mean, there's the whole Jesus thing at the end with her mom. It's not subtle at all. It's just like, come on, really? But it says something about revenge. This film is two things for me. One is you mentioned Rosemary's Baby earlier.
Yeah.
It's part of this whole, and The Brood is another really good example of that too, where it's all about, like, it's kind of motherhood.
Yeah.
It's sort of about pregnancy, and it's about motherhood. It's this whole idea of sinister mothers.
Prenatal weirdness and period blood.
Right. Yeah, it is. That was a big theme for horror films, especially in the 60s, a little bit in the 70s. The whole thing with abortion,
there's a lot of who to baby daddy going on in the 70s.
Right.
Plus there's all the abortion stuff. And everybody from the younger generation is now moving into the motherhood generation.
Right, right.
And like the filmmaking generation that had the balls to make horror films, you know, Herschel Gordon Lewis aside, because that guy's a crazy motherfucker. The younger generation, you know, the people like the Dennis Hoppers who made things like Easy Rider.
Right.
And the people who originally grew their balls to make films like about the road and about drugs, you know, those kind of people are finally moving into something much scarier than the road and drugs.
Parenting. Yeah. So there's that whole dialogue going on, too. And I mean, that really informs the movie. We don't ever really talk about historically what's going on with horror films. Which, in a way, I feel like sometimes we should, but you and I, like, we're just not historians. We weren't alive back then. We don't know the culture. But horror movies are always a great reflection of what's happening at the time.
As Stuart Gordon said, horror movies are a really good commentary on what people are uncomfortable with.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they totally are. In pushing people's buttons, I think that's something Stuart Gordon is always looking at in his films. So Carrie is a movie that straight from the beginning aims to make people uncomfortable in that way. Here's for all of the kind of sad filmmaking that goes on in Carrie and how eye-rolling John Travolta is in that movie and all of the terribleness that is there. I really love Carrie as a piece of cinema for two reasons. And one of those reasons feeds into the other, so I might as well just do them in order. One is that this is a prototypical revenge movie, and it is nothing else.
Nothing else.
It does one thing. It follows this girl. You see people make fun of her. You see how down she is. And then at the end, you see her get her revenge. They don't do any side stories. There's no other comment. There is literally nothing else this movie wants you to take away from it. Not even really religious messages.
Right.
Even the religious imagery just serves the revenge and the martyr story.
Stephen King always puts his religious bullshit and his period blood in anything he can get.
So I like that it is all just one driving point, and that makes the film go through really fast. You kind of know where the film is going, and so you're just building towards that point. Everything is constantly building, and part of the reason that point is such a payoff. We kind of grow to hate a lot of the characters. We have different feelings, obviously, towards the different characters. But when we get to the end, and this is the other thing that I think is really interesting and you never get in revenge movies, is that she's exacting revenge on everyone. She's not only exacting her revenge on the people who betrayed her, but friends who weren't necessarily in on it. Her teacher, who was actually really sympathetic to her, who defended her through the whole movie, she gets revenge on...
Bitch gone crazy, right?
Right, yeah. There's just no clear aim to these people. She's just trying to burn everyone alive and kill everyone. And I think that says something about revenge, right? It's kind of like, hey, revenge might feel good, but it's kind of stupid when you actually think about, you know, what good is it doing beyond just harming the people themselves? And does that do any good? She's inadvertently, as she's tearing down the gymnasium and everything is just going to flame, and she's giving everybody a pretty bad prom night. She's destroying the lives of people who, even people who helped her. And I like that commentary on revenge. You don't get that a lot in revenge movies. Right. It's always like, this person wronged me and I'm going to get back to that. And you know, that's a cool thing too. But I rather enjoy, oh yeah, your revenge might also fuck up other people's lives, yeah, too.
Well, plus it looks goddamn cool. Like, there's really not a whole lot in horror history that can be more iconic than a pig's blood covered Sissy Spacek burning a gym to the
ground.
Burn
it all down. And I love Sissy Spacek in it, too. I know that's another thing where people are either like, huh, I remember that shitty Sissy Spacek movie, or they're like, Sissy Spacek is so amazing. But she's just really awkward and perfect for that mm-hmm. role, and a role that, if you did the movie today, would turn into a bad teenage hipster movie with monsters in the coffee shop.
Michael Cera.
Oh, God.
Welcome to 2010.
A couple quick things to wrap up here. People do still fuck up the date, right? Yep. So it is 2010, but people still say 2010. That's never going to change, and there's no point in complaining about it anymore. But I refuse to budge. Next year is 2011. Fuck you, everybody.
2011, the year of the taco.
The year of the what? I don't even know what you're talking about right now. Speaking of tacos, the Grindhouse DVD is out, as we mentioned on the Machete Show. I couldn't believe that day would actually come. But both Planet Terror and Death Proof are on one... they're probably not on one disc. It's probably just both of the DVDs wrapped in cardboard or however they do that. But it's not. There are special features, and there is a cooking school, which is really the only reason to buy that DVD, or reason enough, I guess I should say. And all the trailers have been replanted back into the double feature, so you can watch it just as you did in cinemas, sort of. Hobo with a Shotgun is now a full-length film. God, this is weird. And as far as double features concern, Dennis Hopper never died.
I'm kind of crying now. Thanks for that.
We never got a chance to talk about that on the show. I believe what happened is, and we never talked about this either, we recorded the Blue Velvet show right before Dennis Hopper died. And then I was mixing it together. We go to post it and Dennis Hopper dies. That was a big bummer.
That was rough.
Obviously, we didn't mention it on the show. We were all on suicide watch for you. Me and the producer of the show and just the two of us, I guess, making sure that, you know, Dennis Hopper was sickly ill for a while, and we were really worried that you would do something awful when the news came.
Yeah.
But it literally, I mean, remind me if this is true or if I'm making it up, but didn't everyone you know call you that day and ask how you were doing?
A lot of people did. At least five people.
I went into a bank that day, and the woman asked how I was doing, and I try not to give cookie cutter responses when people say that, because that's a chance to have human interaction. So I say, oh, you know, whatever, I'm having a good day, or this happened today, or whatever. Just kind of throw them off a little bit. And so that day I said, you know, Dennis Hopper just died, so I'm a little bummed. And she goes, oh, were you close? And it was so sad that through the man's career and everything he had done, there are still people who don't know who Dennis Hopper is. It was tragic, but it did make me giggle a little bit, because, I mean, well, who fucking responds like that?
Yeah.
Dennis Hopper died, were you close? How are you doing
these
days?
I'm good. You know, I wrote a song about it, so it's all.
Is that available now? Can people get that yet? Should they watch glittermouse.com?
It will be soon, yeah.
All right, so the real conversation here is Music Box Massacre shows. Should we do this again?
All right,
here's... Now, let's lay out some pros and cons here really quick, if you do that for me.
All right, so the pros are, it's fun. I mean, it's fun to go to the Music Box. We get to do a bunch of films that a lot we've never heard of, and a lot we probably wouldn't cover in a normal setting.
So as we do this pros and cons list, actually, you just reminded me of that. Let's answer this question first. Should you and I go to the Music Box this year?
The theater or to the massacre?
Yeah, to the massacre. Oh. Should we do that? What are the pros and cons of that?
Well, the cons of that are it's too long.
Okay.
It costs a lot of money.
Right.
MC.
Oh my God, that fucking guy. I think he's still there this year, so that's enough of a reason not to go.
The movies are too shitty this year.
They are kind of shitty this year.
There's a lot of Toby Hooper.
Yeah, not necessarily a bad thing, but kind of weird that there's...
It's usually a bad thing.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah. If it doesn't say Texas or... I mean, I think they're showing Poltergeist, which I'll swallow Poltergeist.
Okay. I haven't seen it, so that seems like a thing I should see.
I think they're doing The Funhouse, which is atrocious.
We don't even have the list in front of us. That tells you how much we're interested in the Music Box Massacre
and,
this year.
I mean, I don't know. Then we have to record the show, and then we have to make you guys listen to something we did a year ago. It takes the place of something else that we could be doing. We could be doing another pair of films and actually cover each film instead of kind of glaze over a bunch of films that we'd like to fully cover. Pontypool, good example.
Sure.
Another good example. Yeah. Films that we've kind of had to glaze over because we couldn't...
Bucket of Blood, man. We couldn't say anything about that movie. And you know, we do these little things and we do them spoiler free. We don't like doing a spoiler free show. Other people like when we do that. I don't really care that they like that. If we did a thing where we just reviewed the movies that come out that week and don't spoil them and give them a review, our show would have 100 times the listenership, probably 1,000 times the listenership. Half the people in the country would listen to that bullshit because people like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to do that. That's just not, I don't want to just replicate what other shows do. And I don't have as good of a time when we talk about spoiler-free stuff. So, I mean, even if you and I didn't go, hypothetically, just to put all our options on the table here, we could, in theory, just hang out in the studio and watch the movies.
Yeah.
Or hang out somewhere with, you know.
We could fucking hang out and watch the same amount of movies that we choose or that somebody else chooses.
That's true as well. Yeah.
Because the movies this year particularly is standing out as films. Because I've seen the majority of these films. And aside from Psycho, Poltergeist, and maybe a few others, I do not care.
Okay, so here's the other issue with that, with doing this show, is that if we just picked out random, you know, 12 random movies or however the fuck many there are, and did them on our show and called it the Music Box Massacre, most people would never know the difference.
Yeah, that's
because
true.
The Music Box Massacre is just a Chicago event, and there's a lot of people who listen to our show or in Chicago or who, you know, come all the way out here for the massacre, but not everybody. So we do alienate a large section of our audience who didn't sit down and watch all. It's one thing to say 2 movies every week, watch them up front, right? And a lot of people don't do that. And some people do, and those people are really, really awesome. But to say, hey, watch these 12 movies, we're going to talk about them for 4 minutes each.
Sure.
It kind of seems like a waste of everyone's time.
Including, you know, our own.
Right, right.
And we have, time is money for us.
Yeah.
We have to pay the producer by the hour.
Where is she at, by the way?
We didn't pay her.
All right, so it's a waste of our time, and it's an even bigger waste of the audience's time, and I don't know why people even listen to this show, probably just because it's spoiler-free, and we can just say shows are spoiler-free and spoil them anyways, and that last one's probably not true. That would be a really awful thing to do. But so we're in a position much like the Killapalooza. The Killapalooza, by the way, is, I'm pretty sure, the only thing from year one that we've kept,
sure,
besides watching 2 movies. And yeah, even that, as we've seen on today's show, is not something we've kept.
Unfortunately, the hosts.
Yeah. So, you know, I think we should just remove everything but the 2 of us from year one, and that'll push us in a direction of a better show. And one of those things is Music Box Massacre. Now, we wanted to do a marathon thing on the show because we haven't done a Killapalooza in a while. There's one that's going to be coming up. We are bringing those back. But just as we needed to stop and examine the Killapaloozas to make those better, and goddammit, they will be better, we need to kind of stop and go, should we even do the Music Box Massacre next year? Do you want us to take a week out and watch the films?
We will do it. It's not, yeah, we're not saying that if Podmanity comes out and says, yeah, no, we really like these, then yeah, we'll fuck it, whatever, $22 is not a big deal.
Or it's, we'll just watch them at home, right?
Yeah, I mean,
because no one will let us know in time, so we'll probably just watch them all at
the
home.
The timeout to do it is not the issue here. We, yeah, just don't want to bore everybody.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So, one, is there a better idea for this? Or two, should we just maybe do another Killapalooza, do 4 a year, or do a different lineup of movies?
Should we
maybe
do a trilogy?
Yeah,
show?
I was gonna say, do one trilogy a year or something.
That way we
to that
could
effect.
Get some Spy Kids, some Back to the Future.
Yeah,
some...
and we wouldn't have to keep doing this bullshit where we do one piece of a trilogy.
Yeah, the Prophecy
and
Terminator experiment from year one.
From year one, more shit from year one.
I like the trilogy idea. If you like the trilogy idea,
yeah,
that's
not
of
a bad idea. We just
chuck that in.
We should just fire this producer. This is fucking her job
we don't
to
have
come
a
up with this shit.
Today.
We just keep asking the audience to do what the producer should be doing. All right, well, regardless, I still think the guy who MCs is a prick, and as long as he's doing it, I'm not really going to promote that show. They're not giving us anything to promote these shows, right? We're under no obligation to do an entire show.
Eventually, we'll be hosting them, and we'll be picking the movies, and we'll be asking you to come from North Carolina.
Are you just baiting me to talk about that, or I'm not sure what you're doing here? I'm not, no. That's, you know what? That's gossipy shit, and I'm not getting into these Chicago politics on our show. Email me, I'll tell you all about it. No, but fuck it. I'm not doing it, and I'm not going to mention the date or all the goddamn movies that are coming up, because that would be a pain in the ass, and that would just make the show even worse than it's already been. So we're going to do something totally different next time, and by totally different, I mean back to what we usually fucking do.
We're going
to
do the Back to the Future movies.
No, we're not doing the Back to the Future movies. That's...
Oh, you mean next time? I thought you meant next Killapalooza or Massacre. What are we doing?
Cemetery Man and the Addams Family.
Watch more fucking film.
Bye. But to say, hey, watch these 12 movies, we're going to talk about them for 4 minutes each.
Sure.
It kind of seems like a waste of everyone's time.
Including our own.
Right, right.
And we time is money for us. Yeah. We have to pay the producer by the hour.
Where is she at, by the way?
We didn't pay her.
Right, got it.
That was fucking Marx Brothers shit right there.
I don't know what happened there.
Pay who?
The producer.
What producer? Why isn't she here? We didn't pay her. Who writes her check? Anyways, sorry.
Who writes the checks? I thought it was what?
No, what does the producer do?
Oh. Oh my God. More cough medicine.